Welcome. If you haven't had a chance to meet me yet, I am Dr. Gail Watkins, and I am thrilled to welcome you to our Breeder College call on October 13th, 2021. I think we are now at 9.5 years of doing Breeder College calls, and so thrilled to be here tonight and glad you could join us. Hang on, let me get a few more people in and then I will go ahead and get started. So the way we run this, these are simply Q&A calls or conversation calls or discussion calls. The way we run them is first come, first serve. So please don't be shy. Don't sit there and think, oh, I'll just ask at the end, because often we run out of time. And I want to make sure that everybody gets their comments or their discussion or any questions that they have. If you have a comment on a question, please put it in the chat or feel free to unmute yourself and go ahead and step into the conversation. I'll just start with some comments on the Doberman National, which was just there, Tennessee. Kingsport, Tennessee. What a great national specialty that was. I made my husband come. It's still ongoing, but it was just a tremendous, tremendous event. And I was so honored to be there and have the opportunity to meet so many people and just see such fabulous dogs. It really, I've done a lot of national specialties in the last 10 years, and obviously the golden specialty for the last 40. And this one was really great. And if you haven't had the opportunity to go to a national specialty, think of it as a national convention. And even for those of you, so every purebred breed that I know of in the United States has a national convention or specialty every year. But a lot of the mixed breed clubs do as well. I've spoken at the ALIA, the Labradoodle convention. I've spoken at the Golden Doodle convention, and they're fabulous. They really focus on education. There's a lot of seminars. And so I would really encourage you to try to make the effort to go to your breeds convention or specialty if you can. It is an opportunity to network with people, to connect with people, and often it's really an amazing educational opportunity. If you happen to have golden retrievers, ours starts next Friday, and I think we have something like 2,000 dogs entered. So if you want to just revel in golden retrievers, show up in Ocala, Florida, and you will see every size, shape, age, and you can pretty much do anything you want to do with a golden retriever. As Renee says, it is a great excuse for a vacation. So the last trip I did was February 19th, pre-COVID. So was that 2019? I can't even remember how long ago it was. But the last national I've been able to go to was 5 years ago. And I cannot wait until next week to go and just spend 10 days with golden retrievers. And the Doberman National is 11 days. So you can go and see agility, obedience, working sports, hunt test field trials. It really is just a great opportunity. Renee, it sounds like, is heading out. Is this to the Bloodhound National, Renee, in San Diego? That sounds amazing. So think about it, track it, put a search on Google so that you know when these things are happening. And I think you'll find that they are some of the best dog education, aside from maybe Good Dog and Avidog, but some of the best dog education that you can get. And if you're trying to do something like understand structure a little bit better, and that I think is an ongoing pursuit for all of us, even pet dogs. I mean, a lot of times we poo-poo structure in pet dogs, but every dog needs a functional structure. So it can breathe, it can see, it can move, it can go for walks with its family. And one of the best places to learn about structure, in my opinion, is at your national. So there's my commercial for the evening. And now I will turn it over to you guys. And it looks like Teresa has her hand up. Teresa, can you unmute?
Hi there.
Hey there, how are you?
Good. I just got Esme spayed yesterday. She's seven and a half years old. No reason other than just don't want to have another whoopsie in the house, a pregnancy.
Or a pio, you know.
Yes, that's maybe, yes, very much that. Yes, we don't need to go down that road. Any suggestions on making the recovery a success for her?
Yes. So be more rigid than she's going to want you to be with regard to exercise for the first 10 days, 14 days. It's major abdominal surgery on girls. And typically by day three, they're ready to go back to normal activity again. And Nick is actually getting neutered tomorrow. And we have his Adaptyl collar. We have the Adaptyl diffusers. I have calming chews for him. And I have his X-Pen set up. And he's just moving in there for 10 days. And we're going to be really low key with him. Lots of background noise. So the TV will be on all the time. So he doesn't have an excuse. You know, Nick is our bear alarm guy. So he has found bears on the back porch before, but he also thinks there are a lot more bears on the back porch than there actually are. And so I would prefer that he not leap to his feet and start charging around the X-Pen. So with Esme, I think with the girls, it's even more important that we keep them under control because it's just a bigger surgery. And as hard as it is, keep an Elizabethan collar or some sort of surgical suit. The good thing about bitches is you can use surgical suits and it's not a problem. It's much more difficult with the males just because of where the incision is. But if you have a surgical suit or you have one of the Katahdin sled dog suits, keep it on her so she can't mess with her sutures. Does that help? Oh, hi, honey. Is that helpful, Teresa? You're muted. Let me see if I can get you unmuted.
Yes, thank you. That sounded like my plan. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we just have to be the adult in this conversation because they're going to do all they can to talk you out of that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you again.
Good luck. I hope all goes well.
Yeah, sure it will.
I see a note from Colleen. It's actually calming chews. I'll put it into the calming chews, which have L-theanine in them. I just put it into the chat. And the one that we tend to use is Vermont Naturals Calming Chews. They're relatively inexpensive. They're very well made. The dogs like them. So it's like a cookie. And they have L-theanine is an amino acid. And so it's a very natural product and it is naturally calming to dogs. It's the amino acid that tends to bring down excitement. And so it can be very effective for times when you need to keep them confined. I've had two young dogs about 5 months of age have very serious injuries and require extensive rehabilitation. And those calming chews, and then I'll put in the collar. So the Adaptyl collar or diffuser. You can get all of this on Amazon. Adaptyl collars are another calming product. This is, it's like an odor. It's a pheromone, so it's not quite an odor, but it's, for us, it's kind of similar to that. And it brings the dog down and calms the dog. It is not a drug. It's not a sedative. It doesn't do any of those things. All it does is make the dog feel more comfortable. It's like us in lavender or something like that. Colleen asks, can you use calming chews on pregnant bitches? You absolutely can. Yes, they're safe to use. Dosing's on the package, so you can go ahead and do that. And Purina has that new probiotic out, and I'm not remembering the name of it right now, but it has also been shown to be perfectly fine on pregnant and lactating bitches. And so that is another thing you can combine, and you can use all of those things at once. So you can use the calming chews, you can use the adaptive collar, and you can use the probiotic if you have a dog that really needs to be settled, be calm, be stable at because of an injury, a surgery, or just anxiety. So highly recommend all of those. Calming care.
The probiotic from Purina takes 6 weeks to take effect.
Oh, does it really? So yeah. Start now. Renee says it's calming care. Calming care is the name of that probiotic. Terrific. Celeste, since you can just unmute. I see your hand.
Okay, I'll unmute. Well, I'm getting really used to this unmuting and muting. Okay. if you can you talk about some of the risks of doing a planned C-section? I'm hearing so many people now are doing that. Almost, it seems like, because the vet is open and we're going to schedule it. And I was talking with Tracy today and she brought up something that I didn't know. And maybe you can touch on that. She just had a C-section and her doctor had said it's a second C-section, I think, on her bitch. And he talked to her about the thinning of the uterus in certain spots or something like that. So anyway, that's kind of what I would like to hear, if you can talk about it, because if it's not that big of a risk, maybe I'm missing the boat by not doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question, Celeste, and one we all need to wrestle with. So what is the benefit of doing planned C-sections? Your vet is open. You often know who the surgeon is going to be rather than going to an ER at 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And there is decent evidence that more puppies will survive than a natural whelping. And there is, in Avidog, there's a report on stillborn puppies that goes through the research that's compared C-sections with oxytocin and things like that. So I really recommend that to you. So why don't we all do C-sections if we're going to get more puppies out of it? Well, there are a couple of reasons. Number one is the risk of your bitch dying in a natural whelp is pretty close to nothing. There have been bitches that have died from whelping, but it is extraordinarily rare. The numbers of bitches who die from C-sections have gone down a lot in my 40 years, but they are not nothing. And if you see a bitch that has died from a whelping, it is usually from a C-section, either emergency or a planned C-section. And so here we are balancing the benefit of getting more puppies to the risk of death to our bitch. And for me, I will always come down on the bitch's side, because she didn't, most of them did not ask to get pregnant. There are a few who, you know, make it their job to get pregnant, but the vast majority of the bitches that we work with get pregnant because we require them to. We do the AIs, we do the TCIs, we do the natural breeding. And so this is not something that they volunteered for, and is it worth their life? So that's one. Two, we usually, I'm not even going to say sometimes, I'm going to say we usually see a decline in mothering from C-sections. very, very, very common in maiden bitches who are having their first litter and they have a C-section. And if you think about it from the bitch's perspective, she's never had puppies before. She doesn't know anything about this. She goes to sleep. She wakes up and there are now 9 things eating her. You know, they don't know that it's nursing. They have not gone through the process. So whelping triggers all of this flood of hormones, oxytocin, lactation hormones, all of those things work together so that mothering happens. Mothering is not a natural reaction for any dog to a puppy. And so it does not happen without this process or without lactation. And the presence of puppies, the sound of puppies, the smell of puppies, and lactation will usually trigger mothering behaviors over 2 to 3 days. But let me tell you, those first 24 hours can be pretty brutal if you have a bitch that's trying to kill her puppies, will not go near her puppies, who is absolutely terrified. You have to hold her down. You have to muzzle her. And that's incredibly common post C-section, and it's not good for the puppies. And so all of that stress on the bitch's part elevates her cortisol levels. When her cortisol levels are elevated, it goes into the milk. And that early milk is what's creating the puppy's stress management system, their adult stress management system. So that's part of that process. And so now we have a bitch that isn't mothering and is highly stressed. And so we have puppies that are being affected by it, and they're being affected by it, their adrenal glands, their brains, their immune systems. We also know that C-section puppies have different microbiomes. So the microbiome is the trillions of bacteria that are in our puppies' guts. So human beings are born with some microbiome. They get some in utero. Puppies don't. They get none. They get it from birth and then the days following birth. And C-section puppies have a different microbiome than puppies that are born vaginally. In addition, their white blood cells are a little bit different. So their immune system is different because they didn't go through the normal process of birth. And C-section births are more stressful on puppies than a natural birth. I know in our minds, we're thinking, holy cow, you got to get squished down that tube and there's all this pressure and it's this long sort of dark passageway until you're born. But it's less stressful for a puppy to undergo that than you're sitting there and you're thinking life's really good and you're floating around in your mom's belly and boom, all of a sudden you're out. And then think about what happens to puppies during a C-section. If you haven't had the opportunity to see puppies during a C-section, they are scrubbed. They have tubes going down their throat. We're cleaning them out. And we are really scrubbing them hard. So it's a more stressful birth to be born via C-section. So we walk this very fine line between we don't want to risk our bitch to having a ruptured uterus or having a difficult whelp that is something she can't do. She's got stuck puppies or something. Or we're risking her life from an anesthesia, abdominal incision, and then, I mean, the recent bitches that I know have died have either died from bleeding out or they've died from sepsis. So there isn't an easy answer, Celeste. And in some breeds, we have to, we must. Bulldogs, Frenchies, we really don't have a lot of a choice because they're not going to be born naturally. But if you have a choice, I would recommend that you tolerate the inconvenience of a natural whelp to give both dam and puppies the benefits that come from it. That said, I just C-sectioned for my last litter because there was just no way that those puppies were coming out. So it isn't that we ever want to risk the bitch. We just want to make a decision that balances the downsides, the negatives, with the upsides. That covered, Celeste?
Yeah, I had no clue about all that stuff, especially with the stress and the milk and the white blood cell count. I mean, I just figured it was a risk in surgery, you know, and that was an anesthesia and that was about it. But man, that just is, it's profound, the risk. And yeah, I kind of always thought it was easier on the bitch for giving birth, you know, for whelping. But I can see how it wouldn't be. Now, those, the puppies, like say half the litter, most of the litter was born naturally, and then you had to have an emergency C-section because of a stuck or a dead puppy or whatever. Are the ones that were born naturally have the problems with the stress and the milk and all that stuff?
Typically much less so, because the bitch has undergone all of those hormonal transitions during the whelp. And so she has the oxytocin already. And if those puppies had the opportunity to nurse, she's got all the lactation hormones going. And so typically we will not see as much refusing to mother their puppies if there are some pups born naturally. Now, you can still have bitches. I mean, we had a wonderful, wonderful bitch long ago in Avidog who whelped her litter naturally. And at about the halfway point, she decided they were all monsters and literally for 3 weeks tried to kill those puppies. And her poor breeder had to hold her down and have people with her and had to muzzle her. And then at the 3 week point, it was like a light switch. And she became an amazing mother. And we have videos in the course of her playing with her puppies and being this unbelievable mother. So there's a lot of sequences that are happening physiologically that we just really don't understand. And obviously we're going to use calcium and we're going to use intranasal oxytocin after the puppies are born to try and encourage the dam to mother, but there's a lot of it that's just kind of luck. And we are going to stack the deck in the bitch's favor and the puppy's favor in a natural whelping more so than a C-section. But do the C-sections if your puppy's lives are at risk and your bitch's life is at risk.
Yeah, I understand that. So that oxytocin that we give, or they always have you give, after a C-section is sort of helping that along. And the oxytocin we give to as a clean out shot, that probably is a good thing too, right?
It is actually. So oxytocin before whelp has been shown to be a risk. If you read the stillborn report, you'll see
right.
Calcium is always better than oxytocin for survival of the puppies. But sometimes we have to use oxytocin just to get those contractions started. But as a clean out shot, it helps the uterus heal. It helps contractions of the uterus, but it also triggers mothering. And you can continue to give, you can give more injections, but the intranasal oxytocin that your vet can have prescribed for you, your bitch, will assist with mothering and be less rough on the bitch. We know when we give the injections, they start into contractions. And so if it's 36 hours later, she's back to contracting again and it's uncomfortable for her, but the intranasal doesn't have that impact. It does help with mothering. And so that's there's a good research paper in your Litter A to Z about intranasal oxytocin. It was a Australian vet that has written that and really pushed it to help bitches with mothering.
Okay. Thank you so much for going over that.
Sure.
Thanks,
Lest. Cheryl, I see your hand up. I'm going to lower your hand and, oh, can you unmute, Cheryl? That's you.
Yes.
There are you. Hey.
My question.
How are the babies? Do you still have them all?
I have two. They're 14 weeks tomorrow. And I have two. I'm keeping one forever, the girl. And then I'm keeping a boy at least until February when I'm going to meet with the handler who has the other male, and we are going to decide which is the next special.
The next that's the in-show Quaker.
That's what we hope for. I think it's a pipe dream, but we'll see.
Hey.
never know.
You never know.
So I have a question about, so I have puppies that I'm not sure the due date. So I sent it to you as a question, but not till right before the meeting. So you may
I didn't see it. Yeah, no, I didn't see it.
So if you go based on ovulation, 63 days from ovulation is 10/27. So I have, you know, I have all the different numbers. I mean, she was 0.2 and then 3.8. And then we skipped a day and then she was 8.6. So we assume she
The day in between was ovulation. You have a very strong likelihood of that.
Right. And if that was the case, her puppies would be, or 63 days later would be the 27th of October.
Okay.
But we did the ultrasound and he said they're measuring bigger than expected. And he moved the due date to the 25th. Yeah. So what do you think about that?
When did you do the ultrasound? Day 30 or around 30?
Let me look. I have it. I should have it written down when I did it. I know I have it on the chart. I just can't get it to open when I want it to. You know, every time I've ever done this before, he's told me the measurements, you know, agreed with the ultrasound.
How many puppies? Oh, yes. Go ahead. Sorry.
24. So let's see. We think she ovulated on 8/25.
So around 30 days.
Yeah.
So after a very early in that, the end of the first trimester, beginning of the second trimester, it gets increasingly difficult to do measurements.
Okay.
So when it comes to determining whelping date based on fetal measurements, earlier is better. 30 is not terrible, but 22 is better. Day 22 is better.
And we weren't able to, I usually go at day 25, and this time we weren't able to. And so this is the first time I've ever had them not agree.
And how many puppies did he give you a count?
He said six. There could possibly be another puppy or two, but he's always been right on that too, but he won't. He always says, yeah.
Yeah, not all of them do. They're smart in doing that. But if he's always been right, you can probably assume. So that's a good size litter. It's, you know, so we would expect smaller puppies might be larger. I would, you know, so ovulation is our pinpoint. It is possible that she ovulated at 8, but given she was 3.8 and then she was 8, it is most likely ovulation occurred between those two progesterone rates.
Right.
So I would still stick with your 63 days plus or minus 2 days. So that, you know, 25 is a possibility, 26 is a possibility, 27 is a possibility. But there's no harm in saying, I'm going to section her on the 28th, kind of come hell or high water. I'm not going to wait until that 2 days after the 27th, which,
right,
you know, should be her whelping window. But they will be mature enough, they'll be ready. Even though all those things we just talked about with C-sections, there is a risk to it, but you can always schedule it and say, I'm doing it on the 28th, no matter what. And that way, if he's right on the 25th, the puppies won't be too old. If you're right on the 27th, the puppies won't be too early or too old. And that will be sort of your sweet spot. With large-ish litters, you know, typically they're going to be on the earlier side of the whelping window. So you're going to be 25, 26, 27 would probably be your most likely. So that's a way to handle it. Were you thinking of, I mean, was there another issue involved in that, or were you?
It's just really curious. This is, you know, do I need to be really, do I need to start being ready on the 23rd, since he said 25 was 63 days? You know, do I need to be, I mean, she's had two litters before. She had 8 and 10 puppies before, and she had them exactly 63 days. Even, you know, with the big litter, it was still, or both were big. I just wanted to be just sure and just see what you thought about that, because I've never had them not coincide. But yeah. So you had and schedule a C-section for the 28th, just in case.
Just in case. So if you just looked at the whelping window, the 29th would be fine. But given his information and the information you have, the 28th would be a good, safe day.
Okay.
Do you need to be ready on the 23rd? Oh, Cheryl, they're bitches. Like, sure. because what do you have planned? Do you have a wedding in the 23rd? Because she'll be sure to have them then. But
that makes the whelp huge if you.
I know. I would not. I mean, I'd have everything set up and obviously be monitoring her. But do I think the 23rd is likely? I would say no. He's probably saying that the early side of the whelping window is where he's thinking they're going to come. So 25, 26, 27.
Okay. All right. Well, that.
Cool. More babies.
Oh, and by the way, so I always have a problem with, so we did a frozen surgical, her last heat cycle. He wanted to do it 3 days post-ovulation. I thought, well, that was too soon. And we didn't take. So this time, same thing. And I'm saying, no, it didn't work. You know, I don't want to, we'll do it later. And it's so 3 days was on a Saturday. It was my semen this time. Last time it was an imported from Germany. So naturally, you know, it's a huge expense when it didn't work. But so this time he's never been agreeable to doing TCIs with frozen, but I just asked, would you do TCI and can we do it twice? And he said, fine. So we did it on a Saturday and on a Monday.
So that was day 3 and day 5.
And we, right. This time we got puppies. So I think I was, but then if it being the later time, you know, if I was right on the timing and it needing to be on that Monday, then that doesn't go along with the puppies being older.
Sure, it does. Yeah, it does. I mean, the weird thing about dogs is that we can put the semen in a lot of different times, and the puppies are all going to be the same age. And I know that's really weird, but it has to do with canine reproduction and what happens in cell division. And so even if you put that semen in the day before ovulation, the puppies would still be the same age. Yeah, so...
But a missing
Saturday and the Monday doesn't matter. They're all fertilized and start dividing at the same time.
Yeah. I was just thinking if she had really ovulated earlier, then my Monday day would have been probably too late.
It wouldn't have been. So if Saturday was day 3 post-ovulation, I'm usually breeding day 6 ovulation, which would have been Tuesday.
Yeah. And I have to argue.
Too late.
I got. Yeah.
So. I know. You know, we have to work with our vets, and they have some information and we have other information, and we just have to negotiate. I would say it's a negotiated settlement on when we're going to get that semen in. It sounds like you timed it well, and hopefully you've got 8 in there.
Oh, I'd be real happy with 6.
You have to be a little tired after keeping that crew so long.
They wake me up at 3:30, 3:45. I cannot make them sleep longer. I try to wake them up at night and get them to go out. I mean, at 8:30, they're gone. You can't wake them back. You take them out, put them outside, and they just lay down. And
I have to say, that's a Quaker thing, because Nick is that way. He's like comatose. Like, we're like, dude, you got to go outside. And he is snoring away. Goldens are like, here's a ball. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. They're out. It's 11 o'clock at night. He's like, it is past my bedtime. I am sleeping.
I think it may. Anyway,
I have Stabays, which are a Dutch dog, and they did the same. 8 o'clock, gone to bed. All the puppies. It's like, seriously, what are you doing?
I know. It must be European time. They're on Dutch time.
I know, but this getting up so early is about to kill me. And then I've got puppies due in less than 2 weeks.
You have got to figure, you know, white noise machine and give them a little elf Vandy.
Yeah. But I mean, I let them sit in their crates and cry. And I've tried putting them back in the X pen with the litter box. It's not that they need out, it's that they're up, they're ready to go. I'm not sure what to do, but hey, you said I.
I did. Okay.
All right.
I'm going to move on. Yep. Jen, Caddy is due at any moment.
Yeah.
Are you in the RV?
I am.
Oh, cool.
I have to say, that's a pretty sweet setup in the RV. Everything's within arm's reach. The bathroom, the refrigerator, the sink. The whelping box.
I have to say, I loved whelping in the RV. That was a good whelping.
I think there's a business niche here.
Whelping RVs.
Seriously, I'm so much, I'm less distracted. And yeah. I get more rest. But you have to be organized. You got to have your stuff together and everything, you know, more so than a regular C-section. So I'm loving it so far.
And you can just cruise to the vet, cruise someplace else. It's great.
Right. Well, I have a separate car, so, but that's okay. Yeah. So, and I'll show you my whelping box.
Oh yeah. I love it.
I got some of that bulk. The bulk that you said, citrate, calcium citrate.
That's it.
So she requires 24, it says, I think I did the calculator on A to Z, 24,000 milligrams per day. So how much do I give her between puppies?
Flip the bag.
To start.
The bulk calcium citrate has the elemental calcium listed by teaspoon. So that's elemental. That's how much she's going to get out of each unit. So what is it like 475 or I can't remember.
Well, it says the amount per serving 570 milligrams, but it says suggested use take 23,000 milligrams once or twice daily.
2300.
20. I'm sorry. Did I say 20? I did get two naps in today. That's one teaspoon for 2300 milligrams.
So you can give her, she's about 50.
Yeah, roughly. Yeah.
So you can give her 750 to 1,000 milligrams of calcium between each puppy.
Okay.
You can give her that as soon as you know she's in stage two. So that, you know, sort of end of stage one, and you're thinking we're starting contractions. You can give it to her then. You can give it to her after each puppy. You can give it to her if you have an extended period between puppies. You know, we're pushing for that hour ideally. Maximum of an hour between puppies if possible. And so she can have 750 easily each time through that. Okay. And just do the syringe with the
mix it in with the mother's pudding too.
You can mix it in with mother's pudding if she'll eat throughout whelping. Absolutely.
Yeah, she's still got a ravenous appetite. So it's
good girl.
They're like Labradors.
That is a gift. It really is.
Seriously. And then speaking of other things to sunflower lecithin, can I start giving that right away?
You can. I mean, there's usually not an essential need right as they're whelping.
If you can do it
on her first couple of meals after whelping, that's great.
Okay.
Mastitis rarely happens in those first few days because, you know, it's colostrum and we don't have that same, for the vast majority of bitches, you don't get that let down of milk and all of those things that tend to cause mastitis. Okay. But if you can get her started soon, right, you know, within 24 hours, that's great.
Okay. And then one question about the umbilical cords. Why do you like chlorhexidine versus iodine for cleaning?
So there's research in human beings that iodine does not work as well as chlorhexidine, that it is harsher on the skin. It's harsher on the umbilical cords than chlorhexidine is. And so that's why we moved from, you know, 40 years ago when we were doing iodine, I don't think we had chlorhexidine available to us then. And we've moved towards a still very, very strong, not antibiotic, but antimicrobial, to one that is milder and less harsh for the puppies. Mm.
So if I don't have chlorhexidine, should I just do the dry? I have the iodine, but would it be better to just dry?
I don't think I can tell you. You know, I do dry treatment. So for those of you who aren't familiar with treating umbilical cords, there's dry treatment, which is nothing. Basically, you know, you make sure it's trimmed, you let mom do her thing, and you don't put anything on it and you let them dry up. There is wet treatment. So that's typically going to be either iodine, which is the long traditional treatment, or it's going to be chlorhexidine. And that's when you dab the area and you dab it on the cord. I do dry. The only time I've actually used chlorhexidine, I lost the puppy to sepsis. So I was talking to Susan Patterson. I'm like, I think I have been sanctioned for anything but dry. But at the same time, sepsis is an issue and it's a concern. So you kind of have to decide what your risk level is.
Okay.
And if you look at those cords, you know, sometimes those cords are bulbous. They're just big and thick and full of fluid, that's probably a good iodine treatment. Mm. You know, that's one. But the little skinny ones where the blood is drained out and there isn't much to it and it's white, that's probably a safe dry treatment.
Okay, well, that's good.
Is that helpful?
Yeah, very helpful. And if she doesn't happen to chew the cord, do you prefer your fingernails or can you sever it with the hemostat?
You're going to be better off with your nails.
Or is that just the clamp?
Use your nails.
I don't have any nails.
It doesn't take much to tear it. Just saying. They're pretty easy. But you don't want to do a straight slice with a pair of scissors. So you can use the hemostats, let it drain, and then just a little bit of tear. They're not strong.
Yeah. Hopefully she'll do her work, but...
She's a good girl. Terrific. Well, good luck. We can't wait to hear about it, Jen.
Thank you.
Jerry. So Jerry says, can we discuss the variations between due date between LH surge, ovulation, diastasis, and ultrasound measurement? Jerry, can you unmute? There you are.
Hi. So actually we got quite close to some of the answers that I was looking for in the last question. But I think what I'm getting confused about is I did not test for ovulation. I just took the 2 days after LH surge. And we had an LH surge over the weekend. So we think it was Saturday. But when she did an ultrasound measurement of the puppies, and it was 21 days, so which is, I believe, when all puppies are the same size, regardless of species. And
pretty accurate.
then. Yeah. And so she said it's, so LH Surge on Saturday has due date on the 18th, which is this coming Monday. LH Surge on Sunday has it at the 19th, and ultrasound has it on the 19th. So she measured them for the 19th. But this dog is enormous. She's gained 5 pounds and she's an 11 pound dog.
Whoa. And do you know how many?
We counted six. So Tracy came over on Saturday and we counted six.
Oh, that's right. You got Tracy.
Yeah. Yeah. So we counted one. I'm not 100% sure wasn't on the other side, but she's definitely got a lot. And so I want to understand what's my earliest that they may possibly come, or that it's safe for them to come based on that. And then for my future reference, like, what else do I need to be doing to get kind of a more accurate window?
So your most accurate is diestrous. Okay. And so if you can learn vaginal cytology and do the smears, then your best bet is going to be diestrous. But it requires
a microscope for that, right?
You have to get a microscope. Okay. Yep. You can get a kid's microscope for like $100 on Amazon. Doesn't have to be a big expensive microscope, but yes. So you need a microscope. You need the stains, the stains that we put the slides in, and then you need some microscope slides and the cotton swabs.
Okay.
And it takes, you know, you have to learn how to do it. Although if you go back through A to Z, there's good slides there. Okay. So you can see them. And frankly, diestrous is, of all the things you're looking for on vaginal cytology, diestrous is the easiest because they go from cornified to not cornified in 24 hours. I mean, it kind of punches you in the face. It's very rare that they ease into diestrous. It's really common that they ease into estrus and they draw it out and they, you know, go 40% and then 43%. But from estrus to diestrous is rapid. So that's your most exact. But second to that is LH. Now, did you do an LH test, the actual test, or did you just do it off of progesterone?
Progesterone.
So the LH surge can happen between 1.5 and 2.5 nanograms per milliliter. And so it isn't, you know, they can be 1.0, 1.2, 1.5, 2.3. And so without the LH test, it's not a home run on determining LH unless you have a bitch that goes 1.0, 2.0, 3.8. And I don't know what you're...
You went from like 0.5 to like 5.5. So Friday to Monday.
So LH does sound like Saturday,
yep.
But it could have been Sunday. And the thing, you know, the LH surge is 12 to 24 hours. So it could be 3 o'clock Sunday morning. You know, we talk about Monday and Tuesday, and Wednesday, but in reality, it's, you know, a time. So when we look at LH, we are typically looking at the LH peak 65 days plus or minus 2 days.
Okay.
Although we're typically, if we have an LH test, we're thinking 1 day, but it might be vary by 2 days. So the 18th, if between the 18th and the 19th, you're going to be looking at a whelping window starting the 16th or 17th and going to the 20th or 21st. So if she whelps on the 16th, they're going to be fine. They're not too early. They are not premature. They're on the early side of the whelping window, but by no means is that a concern. They're going to have hair. They're going to be puppies. If she starts whelping today or tomorrow, they're more likely to be on the premature side, but they still can be fine. Premature is much better than late in puppies. And when I say premature, I don't mean a week premature. I mean, you know, 48 hours, 24 hours. So if she were mine, I'd be looking at Saturday and be taking her temperature, as long as it's not freaking her out, taking her temperature, hoping for a temp drop, and be looking at 16. I'm sorry, my calendar's over the top of my computer screen. I can't see very well. I think 16 through 20 would probably, I'd be ready on the 16th, but I wouldn't be expecting them until really 17 or 18.
I'm ready. I'm making collars now. Look at that.
Oh my gosh.
Now this one got a little cut short because I made a mistake, but I mean, I had 97 gram puppies the last time. So I think that is probably too big.
You have got to put pictures up. Cannot wait to see them.
I will. So thank you. That's very helpful. Cause I just, I'm like, I can't imagine she's going to make it to the 19th eating 24 ounces of food a day.
Yeah, no. And with large litters, they tend to come earlier.
Okay.
And so I would be ready over the weekend.
Okay. I set up my whelping box yesterday. So I set everything up. So I've got everything lined up. I just need a new scale, which should be here tomorrow. So
good luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
I'd like to hear about it. Renee has a comment that I think is really important, and that's the state of vet care options today may push us to do C-sections when we might not normally want to or choose to do them. And that's definitely the case. If you are looking at having to go to multiple ERs or an ER that spays, that requires bitches to be spayed, then yeah. You may choose to do a C-section rather than take that risk. If you haven't been around, you haven't heard the story of my last litter. It was my first litter in my hometown, which has a very, very limited vet care. And we ended up losing four puppies because of the quality of the vet care. So I'm literally moving to Atlanta to have my next litter, and I'll do all my litters either in a VRBO or in a relative's house in Atlanta, because I simply won't risk it up here. So I do think that's a really valid point, that where we are today with vet care, how difficult it is to get into ERs, how difficult it is to schedule surgeries, it's okay to plan a C-section if that's the situation that you're in. I am going to do Nicole and then go to Leni, who has her hands up. So Nicole says, regarding C-sections, would you recommend a maiden bitch who is 6 years old to go that route, being older and first-time mom as a medium dog, not a breed that typically needs C-sections to go for a scheduled C-section? So Nicole, I don't know. Can you unmute?
Hey,
how are you?
I am good. And this is actually, my photo is the girl.
Oh, look at her.
No, she's gorgeous.
She's gorgeous, but that is snow, isn't it?
Oh God, yeah.
I don't want to think about it yet. So 6 is really not old, Nicole. 7, 8, now we begin to really think about them as senior bitches. But 6 is the tail end. As they hit 6, do we see a higher rate of C-sections and dystocia or uterine problems during whelping? Slightly. So do you know about her mom or her grandmom or sort of that maternal line of how well they whelped?
Yes, actually. Her mom, she had 2 litters. 1 litter but was younger, I don't know exactly what age, but younger than 6. Her first litter, she had 6 puppies, all natural. Her second litter was at either 6 or 7, I am not sure. She had 7 puppies. She whelped 3. And then they had to rush to a C-section. I think she got exhausted.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the exhaustion, which is typically going to be uterine exhaustion. I mean, the bitch can be tired, especially if she hasn't eaten for the weeks coming up to the whelping. But oral calcium really has been shown to help, or calcium has been shown to help maintain the strength of the contractions. So if you haven't used calcium in the past, I would highly recommend. We were just talking to Jen about how much to give between puppies and what the timing was. So I really, really recommend that. It really depends, Nicole. What vet care do you have? Will your vet do an emergency C-section, or do you have a trusted ER nearby?
Yeah, actually, they do. They have a surgeon on call during the weekends and after hours, which is great in case we need it.
So and how
actually run there?
Yeah. So how closely did you time the breeding? Do you have a tight whelping window?
She was not bred yet. She just went into season today.
Oh, got it. Oh, yay.
So I just want to be prepared, you know.
So the tighter you can time the breeding to get the closest estimate of ovulation that you can. So you're going to do that either through the LH, through progressive progesterones, or you're going to do it through diastereomers. The tighter you can get, the better you can determine whether you need to do a C-section or not. So the two, three main reasons we have to do C-sections are the puppies are late, and late is really problematic in dogs. And that's when we end up with a high number of stillborn puppies, because placentas in dogs deteriorate very rapidly after 65 days post ovulation. There isn't a lot of wiggle room in that. And so we want to know when they're late. And then the other two reasons are going to be primary inertia, where the uterus just never starts contracting. And it certainly sounds like she comes from a good maternal line where, and she's not in a breed where primary uterine inertia is common. And then secondary, a puppy is stuck. That's going to be our most common problem, is that somehow a puppy gets stuck, a leg, an arm, something. And so the bitch just can't get that puppy out. And we're trying all of our techniques and we can't get that puppy out. Right. So if you time closely, you can do exactly what we were just talking about on scheduling a C-section at the end of the whelping window, so that we know we've got the C-section scheduled. If she whelps before that, great. But if she doesn't start whelping, we know we can get them out before the end of the whelping window. And that way, and most vets don't have any problem with, you know, you've got a scheduled C-section on Wednesday and you call them Wednesday morning and you say that litter was born last night, and they're fine. They just take you off the calendar. Okay. If you have the opportunity to do an emergency section, then you can play it by ear and say, I am reaching the point of discomfort here where I think these puppies should be born and they're not being born, or she's not going into second stage labor, even though the clock says she should. And so you can make that call then, rather than always doing the 3 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes we have to do the 3 o'clock in the morning, but if we can avoid it, obviously we're going to have better support for the surgeon. The surgeon's going to get in more quickly. There's certainly benefits to having a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. All of that hinges on you timing that breeding.
Gotcha.
And so it's one of the reasons, I know progesterone testing costs us money, but so does losing a puppy.
Yeah.
And it could be the puppy, you know? Right. So we've got the financial aspect of it. You know, you've lost puppies, you paid for a C-section, all of those things. But there's also if you're breeding for the puppy, You don't want to lose that puppy. And so timing the breeding, I think, will. And what kind of semen is it?
It is frozen.
It is. Oh, yeah. So you're doing a six-year-old maiden bitch with frozen semen. You are going for it.
We take risks. We take I like old school.
And are you doing
surgical
or TCI?
So this vet showed us some studies on transcervical having potentially better results.
Yep, slightly. Yep.
That's the route we're going.
Yeah, I think that's great. The only thing I would say, and I'm just going to toss it out there, because I have done most of my frozens have been with TCIs in the last 15 years since TCIs really became common. But with a six-year-old bitch, what you will not gain from a TCI is the ability for the vet to look at that uterus. So I don't know if you had the opportunity to see the really gory photo that Celeste put up last week of her seven-year-old, how old was she, Celeste? Seven-year-old bitch's uterus?
Yes, seven.
Seven, yeah.
I didn't, but I feel like I need to.
It's pretty ugly. And it's from-
She wouldn't let me put it in the top picture. So it's in the comments. I wanted to go for it and put it in the top picture. I mean-
I was thinking, like, you wake up in the morning, you got your coffee, you click into Facebook, and that's what you're looking at. So, Nicole, as many bitches age, not all, but many bitches age, their uterus undergoes an aging process called cystic endometrial hyperplasia, or CEH. And CEH will often end up with uterine cysts. And when, you know, we talk about uterine cysts, and you kind of have this feeling like they're little pimples on the uterus. But in reality, they're like walnuts. I mean, they can be really stunning in their size. That will, anywhere where there's a cyst or the uterine lining has undergone these significant transformations, they can't get pregnant. An embryo cannot embed there and survive to a fetus. And so sometimes, and this really is up to your vet, in my opinion, but you can have the conversation, looking at that uterus, and the benefit of a surgical is they're going to actually be able to feel the uterus and say, oh, there's a lot of uterine cysts and I can pop some of them. One longtime Avidog person just got her bitch pregnant after seven tries because they went in and looked at that uterus and were able to pop those cysts, and she was able to get pregnant. So that would be the only reason I would say you might want to talk to your vet about a surgical. We have done TCIs with horrendous frozen semen and gotten puppies. So TCIs are slightly more successful than surgicals, but it's not a huge amount, and you have the age thing. So worth having a conversation with you.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Good luck. Let us know how it goes.
We will. Just a quick note. It's just because, you know, it's our girl. We do feel more comfortable not being able to get her pregnant this time than going towards the surgical. We're newbies at this, and it freaked us out.
I totally get it. And, you know, surgicals, I think you are recognizing surgicals are abdominal surgery. Right. They're not trivial. They're not things we should undergo lightly. At the same time, you know, it depends upon how rare the frozen semen is, how important getting her pregnant is, how important her line is. So, you know, there's no right answer.
Thank you.
There just isn't a right answer. So good luck with it.
Thank you.
I realize I'm going to go back just for a second, Lainey, and go to Jean, because I think I passed it over. And her question was, my bitch is due to come in season in November, is now too soon to start her on folic acid. So Jean, it isn't too soon in the sense that it's going to be a problem for her. supplementing with folic acid isn't going to hurt her in any way, but there's no reason to do it. So unlike human beings, so typically the guidance to humans, people, is as soon as you think you want to get pregnant, go on to folic acid. And that's because we have a much more difficult time knowing when ovulation is in human beings. It's just not as obvious. But in dogs, we know they can't ovulate if they're not in season. And so you can start her on the day she comes in season, and that will be perfectly fine. She does not need to build up folic acid in her body prior to the getting pregnant. It isn't necessary that her folic acid be at a certain level. You just want to make sure that she's got enough folic acid once those eggs have been fertilized. So can you give it to her now? Absolutely. Do you need to give it to her now? No. But if you think you might forget, or somebody else is feeding her, or you know, you're somebody else is responsible, then you can go ahead and start. It's just not a big deal. Cool. Okay. Lainey's got her hand up. Now lower your hand.
Hi. I'm well, thanks. I came in a little bit late, and oh my gosh, now I had one question when my hand went up, but now I've got a bunch of them. I am just hopefully quickly.
Your two biggest.
Okay. Well, I can keep it quick. You were talking about the progesterone, and this is the first time I always have the boy here. So either that or I take my female to a boy in Spokane. And so I'm always using fresh semen. And my method, and I'm a little bit green, I'm just a breeding program manager for a breeder where I do the breeding. I've kind of had my own system of timing. And now that I've gotten involved with some of these things, I'm just like, I want to be a book and just learn all this stuff. But as far as timing, what I've always kind of done, I've done progesterone checks to confirm she's in heat, to you know, make sure it's going up, watching for the surge. But after listening to a couple of these webinars, I've learned about, you know, the whelping window and how to get your whelping window from the LH surge or ovulation. Now, and then of course I wanted to bring it down to specific where, so for instance, I had every other day, I went from 0.2 to 0.4 to 0.9 to 3, and then over the weekend to 7. So I'm assuming.
So it was every other day, 0.9,
0.2,
0.2.
0.2.
No, I know that really works.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
And then we went from 3 to 7 over the weekend.
Okay, so the LH peak was
between 0.9
and 3. So whatever that day was. And then ovulation was 2 days later.
2 days
later. Regardless of what, yep, whatever progesterone was, it could be a 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That doesn't matter.
Okay, so what I have then on, I had a 3 on the 6th. And then
October.
Yes. And then I assumed ovulation then was on the 8th or, you know, right around there, and started putting them together 2 days after that, which I know with live semen, I can put them together right away because it stays in her longer, but or stays alive. But he wasn't available. And kind of surprising, based on her past litters, he wasn't, I mean, he showed a great deal of interest in the beginning. He jumps on and off, but I don't worry too much for a few days because he just seems to know when it's time. So we did have a tie today, which was day 15 of her heat cycle, which is later than we've ever had, but it's probably three days after her being fertile.
Yeah, so if ovulation was the 8th, LH was 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It sounds like he picked her most fertile day.
Yeah, kind of what I thought. And
LH plus six is typically the most fertile day. LH plus seven is good. Read tomorrow.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, yeah, no, that works good. And we bred today, and we'll probably try again tomorrow afternoon, and then she may be done by then. She may be standing anymore.
15th, she'll probably be out.
Yeah, we'll try again tomorrow. And with Lily, the very first time they bred, she was kind of freaked out. We just kind of held her, while they stayed tied. And then when they split up, there was a whole bunch of fluid on the garage floor. We're thinking, oh, wow, weird. They didn't breed again, and she had 10 puppies. And then last year, we might have been a tiny bit late. They brought on day 14, 15, and 16, and she had 5 puppies. Bye. Thank you so much. Good night, Hitter. I'll pick him up in the morning, okay? That's my guardian home. I just picked up the boy. Okay, so that's good enough with that. I got those answers. And now I've picked a date, a whelping window from that surge. Right? 65 or 63? I can't remember.
So it's going to be 65 days from the 6th or 63 days from the 8th. Either one. Yeah, they're the same. And then Pleiser minus 2 days. So 2 days on either side.
Yep. And it's kind of like, then it's kind of just like I've calculated with the breeding. What I've done in the past, and this is a little different now, I can see because she's a day later. I've always said 60 days from the second breeding before I got into learning about progesterone and the surge. And I've, you know, it's been really close. So, and it sounds like it's really, really the LH surge whelping window. So,
yeah. So the thing we always want to keep in mind is the average bitch. That works really well for. The problem is they're bitches. And many of them do not want to be average. And so
right?
Exactly. So I see Mary Livingston on, and I think Mary had a bitch breed at 31, day 31. Later, 37, and had 10 puppies or something. And so when you have the bitches that are in the LH surge at day 9 and you can breed, you know, ovulation on day 11 and you can breed them 13, 15, 17, that's all great. You know, then those estimates work really well. But when you have, and it is not abnormal for a bitch to ovulate on day 27, it is unusual, but not abnormal. Okay. And so what this understanding of the LH and progesterone and our ability to time has given us the ability to include more bitches in our breeding programs who are normal, but they are not average. So
okay,
those
got it.
Two things make sense. And I mean, I remember a breeder with she bred papillons and she had this magnificent bitch. But she said, I always breed on day 11 and 13, and that's it. And the bitch literally never got pregnant because she wasn't looking at the bitch. She was looking at a calendar that was irrelevant to the bitch. So the benefit you have, it sounds like you've had bitches that are pretty average, that they kind of follow what you see in the books. But those bitches that might vary can still produce wonderful litters with wonderful puppies if we are aware of this variation. So I think your estimate has worked because you've had bitches that have followed the average. Okay. What you want to be able to do is respond to the bitches who don't follow the average.
Okay. And the only
get them pregnant.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. This is wonderful. Last thing on this, and then one more question is, on the normal, I mean, the normal, they're closer to average along the lines of getting pregnant and all of that. Our heat cycles, though, with my family here, the heat cycles are, I was thinking Lily here wasn't going to come into heat. She had her last litter and her last heat cycle. She had her last litter on November 12th of last year, and her heat cycle came up, over a year from the one before.
In September, yeah.
The other one we just bred, her heat cycle was about 18 months or 16 months from the one before, which, you know, it's women are different too. I had very different cycles too, so I'm not too concerned. So thank you so much for your help on that. Now, real quickly to C-sections in just a little bit. I listened to the Q&A there and that was wonderful, but after listening to, hopefully it's okay to say it, Dr. Hutch, and him talking about, you know, that timing and whelping, I've listened to that over and over, and his view on C-sections are, well, you always get more live puppies. You know, there's always a better chance that that's not a reason to just have a C-section for whatever reason. But I've only had to have a C-section one time. And it was because our guardian girl, I had two litters last summer and they were sisters. One of them runs miles every day, was super fit. And this was a great lesson for me too. One of them lives in a family where they got too many treats. By the time she was ready to give birth, she was obese. And when she came to me, because she doesn't live in the same town, when she came to me, you know, I was very concerned right away. And our ER clinic is a nightmare here. They do the work, they get it done, knowledgeable there, but everything else is a nightmare. So I had to introduce a couple big names to the vet because they were just blowing us off. But she had one puppy, one giant, healthy baby girl. And about 2.5 hours later, 2 hours later, she wasn't actively laboring. But I assumed the uterine muscle is not going to be very strong. So I'm really on guard. And she started to contract just a little bit, nothing major. But enough time went by that I finally called them and I said, you know, I think we're going to have to be seen. I'll give it a little bit more time. And they kind of blew us off and said, oh, overweight dogs can have, you know, they can have plenty of puppies. And finally had to introduce another specialist that's really well known too, Dr. Lopate, who my breeder has a, yeah. And great. She got on the phone and he treated her like a, just some woman who didn't know what she was talking about until were looking at the ultrasound or something, and he must have done his research because he came back on the phone and he was a different person. But finally went in, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. I laid in my van all night while they did the C-section. All the puppies were fine. One of the pups, another large one, was caught in the canal. Whether or not she was fit enough to push it out, if she were fitter, we don't know. But this is just such a great lesson for me and a great story. Now, the sister had a litter a month later, 13 puppies, 4 hours, just spit them right out. Boom, 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 because she was so fit and strong. And great lesson for me because the difference was huge, bigger than night and day. Just unbelievable. Yes.
Fitness matters in bitches so much, and what a great story for all of us to hear. I don't think I've ever had a whelping longer than 7 hours, and that one was 15 puppies, except for one bitch that I co-owned who showed up obese, and that was 16 hours. I mean, it was hell. So I think your point is so well taken that when our bitches are obese and out of shape, I'm glad all the puppies came out. That's really lucky, but just such an unnecessary experience. And so much better when they're fitter.
Yeah. Learned hugely. And I don't think this family is capable of keeping her at a good weight. So we are done with her. I mean, we love her to death, but we're done. We are not going to take chances. But that's wonderful. And I appreciate that. Shoot, there was one more thing I wanted to say, but I've kept you long enough. And
I'll let you come back in line, Lainey, and if you think of it. I got lots more. Okay, terrific. Good luck.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Mary, do you have your hand up or did you have your hand up? I see
I had my hand up.
Yeah.
Did you take it back down again?
Getting long, so I don't know if you wanted to wait on this until later. I had, Star had a Parvo MDA of 20 on her nomograph. And so she was
lucky.
I know. And her distemper was 16. So I know, right?
Best nomograph ever.
And I did vaccinate her with the puppies at the 5-week optional vaccine, monovalent for Parvo, with the puppies. And we got the vaccines through our veterinarian, who we ordered a couple of flats of them to cover all 14 puppies plus Star. So when I retitered her, she came back at a whopping 40. And then her distemper also went up by one dilution. And so, Tim, could you not do that right now? Thank you.
Hi, Tim.
I know. He's unloading the dishwasher. I should be saying thank you.
Promise to never do dishes again.
Bye, Tim.
Well, that took care of that. With the puppies doing the early vaccine, and of course, when they were vaccinated again at 7 weeks, they all had excellent parvo response. And which actually some of them had really high parvo because they had had two vaccines and probably some responded at 5 weeks. 12 owners titered at 9.5 weeks or they did a titer right before the 10-week vaccine that Dr. Larson had recommended. But what happened with that was that out of the 12 of the 14 that titered, only one responded to the distemper portion. None of the other puppies had a protective level, which was fine because the one that did that is one that is with me. And then I just got a monovalent and did her. Everyone else had already had a second vaccine with the distemper component. And then they all, when they retitered, came back. But Star, the second test that I have, it's only a single dilution. And she even went up on her distemper from 16 to 32, even though she hadn't had another vaccine. So again, it's just a single dilution. And the comment was that she seems to have a low titer in spite of vaccination. Star is, I leased Star, and she is a semi-permanent guest. She's here probably more than she's with her owner. And my concern, of course, is, she'll be going, well, I don't know. The plan has been for her to be returning to her owner. She may wind up being here forever. But she came from a litter with a parvo titer of 25, 60. So this is, and it's dinner time. Everyone's starting to, Tim's scooping food. So the serenading will begin.
Let's just talk about this. So this is a bitch with very low, who maintains very low titers, but protective titers, fully protective titers. So what is important for us to understand on titers, and I'm sort of talking to everybody here, Mary, because I think you know a fair amount of this, is that the titer level that a dog carries, barring coming in contact with the virus, is a characteristic of the dog.
Yeah.
It is not a response to vaccination, to the number of vaccinations. I have gone through the exact same thing there. So I had a dog that maintained a distemper titer of 40, and it didn't matter how many vaccines I gave her. She would go up and she would go back down to 40. And then she would go up and she would go back down to 40. And Dr. Schultz, so this was Dr. Larson's teacher, basically coached me through it because he's like, Gail, she maintains a low titer, but if you want to vaccinate her, and this was, she was born in 2000. So it was a long time ago. And I'm like, I don't think I get this titer stuff.
So I'm going to give her another vaccine. So I gave her three vaccines and she ended up at a 40, and she stayed at a 40 until she was 13 years old. And then she dropped to an 8. So we have to, now, if Star came in contact with the virus, you would probably see her go back to 25-60, but she would then come back down over time to 40. She is not going to go down. So I got into a discussion on another Facebook group the other day where people say, oh, titers drop precipitously in a very short period.
Well, they don't. They're supposed to, though.
In an adult dog, they're going to come back down to that dog's level. Right. And as long as that dog's level is above the protective level, the really important thing for us to know is that higher is not better in titers. A titer of 10,000 is no more protective in parvo and distemper than a titer of 20. There's no benefit to those high titers. It's not like we want them to have high titers. We just need them to have good enough titers. And she's good enough.
And that, see, she hasn't, other than being at our property or at hunting test and or at her owner's property or, you know, various different training grounds, she's not been a lot of different places. However, the dogs that I have that run the 2560, they've gone to work with Tim. So I'm throwing Tim under the bus. And he's, his office is,
he's really never doing the dishes again.
I know. His office is along the Sacramento River. And I know another breeder who takes her dogs to the Sacramento River Trail. And those dogs also run the 2560, you know, on the higher titer. So, that is, you know, it is really nice to send the owners home and to have them. You know, I wish the puppies would have responded to the 7-week distemper and not needed another, but only one out of the 12 that were tested.
That's really interesting. And does Dr. Larson, did you talk to her about that by chance?
Well, she said that when I asked her about that in the email, she said that she doesn't often get puppies testing for distemper at below 10 weeks, at 9 weeks or below. Yeah. And so I wanted to have a little more of a conversation with her because I was just wondering if, you know, if something about the combination vaccine was a bigger issue for him. And we did have one, though, that did respond out of the 12 that ran the early titer and then for the distemper. And then
was it a bigger puppy? Was it a larger puppy? Do you remember? I mean, at 12, they're not going to be that much larger. 14.
Yeah, no, actually, and she's one of the two that I have here that are going out of country. You've got to wait for rabies and all that other stuff. But she, at that point, because right now these two girls are at 4 months old, exactly 27 pounds. They're like only 3 ounces apart from each other.
So kind of
so. But if I go back and look at the birth record and see where they were at that point, the one that responded was like 12th born out of 14. And so she was later in the birth process and she was 14 ounces. And so she was one of the, or 13.6, because the other one that did not respond here was 12.8. They were a real tight
kind of normal. Yeah, kind of normal.
Yeah, we had, you know, there were a couple out of the 14. One was 10.6 and one was 11. And they've all caught up with everybody. Yeah,
sometimes larger puppies will process maternal antibodies more quickly.
Yeah.
But you know, that's a pretty tight group. But
the boy that was born at 17.4 ounces, which was crazy to have this really big litter and a 17-ounce puppy, he didn't respond. See, the one who did respond was kind of middle of the pack.
Yeah. So let's I want to talk briefly and then I've got to move on, but the dogs that consistently test at 2560 who are going to work with Tim near the Sacramento River are likely being challenged by the virus regularly.
Yeah.
And this is another thing for all of us to know, is that if we have fully vaccinated dogs that come in contact with parvovirus or distemper, we'll never know it if we don't titer them, because they will have no symptoms. They will have no response. We will see nothing when we interact with or look at the dog. The only way we know that they might have come in contact with it is by running a titer. And Mary's been in the group a long time, so she's seen, we've had bitches who have had titers of 20,000. And it is unlikely that that is the dog's normal titer. What is far more likely is that it actually came in contact with the virus. So that speaks to a couple of things. It speaks to how phenomenal these vaccines are. I mean, the distemper and parvo vaccines are amazing vaccines. They give what's known as sterile immunity, which is, there are very few vaccines we have that can offer that degree of immunity, where the dog, if it has that immunity, will not respond to the vaccine. You could feed it parvovirus. You could dump parvovirus all over it, and the dog is going to be perfectly fine. So those two vaccines, more than any other vaccine we have for dogs, are just gifts to us. And it's dogs like this that show us how powerful it is. But when we have dogs that are at 2560 or 20,000, their puppies are not going to respond to a vaccination until they're 16, 18, or 20 weeks old. And that's the cost that we pay for those really high titers. It's why Mary and I are saying that a 20 and a 16, which are pretty low titers, are so wonderful, because those puppies are able to respond earlier. They may not have responded to a 7-week vaccine. A lot of that has to do with the maturity of that immune system. It just has to be mature enough to actually be able to mount a response. And I think 5 and 7 weeks.
Yeah, and I think that since there were 14 of them, by the time they got to 7 weeks, they really seemed a little immature. I held them to 8.5, almost 9 weeks before letting them go home, because there were just so many. That was just kind of a thing for discussion there with her. And, you know, if I wanted to experiment, I'd send her to work with Tim and then tire her.
Yeah.
I don't want to mess with this, because I might be able to lease her again. And, you know, what's not to love? 14 puppies and low maternal antibodies.
Pretty perfect. Cool. I'm going to jump, but that's great. That's just wonderful story. And let Tim go back to doing the dishes. Barbara had to leave, but I'm going to say it anyway for the recording. So Barbara asked, when cytology, when do the cells go back to the normal cells? Is it metastress or diastress? So dogs don't have metastress, which is a lot of other species do. They have what's known as diastress, and it has to do with progesterone levels in dogs. And so dogs transition back to parabasal cells in the lining of the vagina at diastress. And so it's usually going to be day one of diastress. They go from on the day prior to that, they're 100% cornified. And then day one of diastress, they're at least 50% parabasal cells, which are the little guys that look like little Cheerios. And they're usually 100% or close to it by day two. So it's a very rapid transition from estrus into diastress. They are often fertile on day one of diastress. So don't put them together if you're trying not to get her bred, but you can often breed on day one of diastress if you can get through the cervix. The cervix is always the issue there. Lynn, I'm going to unmute you. We'll keep going for a little while. I understand if you have to depart, but we'll take a few more questions. Hey, Lynn. I don't know where you went, but.
There we go. Sorry, I had computer issues, so I missed most of it.
Sorry.
Okay, so what the lady said earlier about overweight dogs, yeah, that's Holly. I didn't get her to lose enough weight, and I think that's why she had to have the C-section, because she had a pup stuck in the birth canal. But the vet said that she had adhesions in her uterine horn and in the birth canal.
But interesting.
She had pups just fine last year, but she said she had to actually really pull the puppies to even get them out. So she didn't think she could have had them naturally. So we lost two puppies. We have two healthy puppies from her. Her daughter, Rosie, had 6 puppies 3 weeks ago. The smallest one is really struggling to gain weight. So I fostered it on Holly. And Holly's feeding it enough. But it seems like the other puppies were so much bigger than the runt that the runt was just getting pushed out of the way. And she's just not gaining. She actually lost a little bit a couple days. So I'm thinking just leave her with Holly and let Holly mother her, and then just see. Do you think it would be fine to like just even delay her vaccinations and just get her vaccinated when I get Holly's puppies vaccinated because she's so much smaller?
Yeah, I mean, unless she's going out somewhere where it's going to be a huge risk, sure. There's you know, you're not waiting until she's 6 months old. You're just doing it a short period. So yeah, you can certainly do that.
I'm just thinking maybe just keep her just a couple weeks longer just to make sure that she's good. I mean, she's gaining weight now, but I just want to make sure she's okay. The other puppy's doing fine. I think it's just her first litter and she just doesn't understand that she has to help that little one get nursing. She gets a little bit mad at Holly when she sees the puppy with her, but anyways.
Yeah, well, that'll probably fade. You know, it takes a little while, but I would leave her with Holly and or supplement her.
Kind of
some combination to keep that weight up. Because typically they're going to get over the hump and they're going to be fine, but they expend more energy than they're taking in fighting off their litter mates, trying to get on a nipple, all of those things. So yeah, if it's easier and they're going to expend fewer calories, then that's really what we want to do. And if she's being well mothered, that's a great option.
Yeah, because she's the same size as Holly's puppies. So
yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect.
It fits in. Anyways.
Good. Okay, I'm going to jump and we're going to do an RV tour with Jen, and then I'll see if I can do one more question.
I won't take too long because I know you're running late. I'll post a bunch of things that I kind of discovered on, you know, when things settle down, but I guess just a quick view.
Yeah, do a quick tour.
Let me turn on the light.
There we go.
There's our pool. It's a soft-sided whelping pool.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Who makes that? I've not seen that.
Amazon, of course. Celeste? The only drawback is there's no pig rails, but I feel okay with her. She's pretty, she's got pretty, all the fit to be tied stuff. She knows her stuff. And then the only thing I really recommend is multiple heat sources if you have a failure. So I have my heating pad with my thermometer there. I have a whelping nest if I need to stick them over there for a bit. And then, of course, I have my, I have the box with the microwavable discs too. And since this vehicle runs the heat on propane, I am hooked up to electrical. So I have an electrical plug-in for backup in case, for whatever, if I need extra heat, a blast of heat or something. So.
And are you in dining room? Are you in the dining room?
Yes. So there's the sofa bed.
Yeah.
And see all my Doppler and all my equipment. I even have a Nest Cam up there.
I love it.
And there's the whelping box. And then here's the desk with the booth. It's a mess, but I know where everything is. And then my supplies up there in the bins. And then of course I've got my kitchen right there with all the stuff ready. Pedialyte, calcium, and of course, this is my friend's RV. So look at her kennel set up over there. 5 kennels.
Nice.
I have a spare dog with me too. So, and then of course I have a fence to separate them.
So what a great setup. Yeah, we definitely need some pictures.
I'll get pictures and then kind of a little what I've learned along the way.
And give us the what I've learned before and then what I've learned after.
Exactly, right. So far, so good. But then what did I learn after?
Yeah, exactly.
One quick interesting thing. I just took her temperature. And I remember Dr. Hutch saying something about when the temperature goes down. This is just textbook, right? There is going to eventually be a slight rise in the temperature. That's what she's doing right now. There's a slight rise. So impending.
Yeah. So as progesterone drops, progesterone has to drop in order for whelping to occur. So as progesterone drops, progesterone helps the body maintain an elevated temperature. It's part of, it supplements homeostasis. So the body normally maintains the temperature through other physiological processes. But when progesterone's high, progesterone helps do that. But because of the way bitches go into whelping, they typically have this very, very sharp decline in progesterone. And when that happens, the body has to kick back in to, you know, the body sort of goes, oh, wait, what? I now have to create heat. And the temperature drop happens before the body can kick back in. And then as homeostasis comes back and all the physiological processes suddenly realize they have to elevate the bitch's temperature, now we see that temperature go back up again. So we have that 80% chance that we will catch that precipitous drop when progesterone leaves the body. And now we can time when they're coming, but we expect the temperature to go right back up within typically 12 hours, which is why we're trying to check it every 6 hours in order to catch that point. But then the bitch's body kicks back in and gets the temperature back up again. And now we have sort of a normal process. And then it goes up even higher post-whelp.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, really. It's and different in dogs than most other species. So as dogs have to be that really unique.
Yeah. And for those of you that have bigger dogs, you can buy these bigger and it kind of conforms around your space. You can kind of mold it into the spot. That's why I liked about this for the RV, because it is moldable. Yeah.
And one of the things I was going to say, Jen, one of the benefits of the pools, they usually don't have pig rails, but because the side bends, do we lose puppies? We lose puppies against a hard side and the bitch. Right. And when the pool bends, we often, the puppies will be okay or more likely to be okay than they are when we have a hard sided whelping box.
Yeah. Cool.
Thank you for the tour. Good luck. Let us know how it goes.
Thank you.
Excellent. Yeah, that was terrific. Okay, guys. Well, as always, you have now wasted a perfectly good evening talking about all kinds of crazy things with dogs. Thank you so much for joining us. The recording should be up tomorrow or the next day. So if you want to go back and look at anything, you'll be able to do that. Otherwise, hopefully I will see you on Facebook and we'll continue the conversation. It was wonderful to see everybody. Thanks so much. Have fun with your puppies. Bye.